From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If the Live 8 concerts left you wanting to hear more about Africa, stay tuned. On today's Fresh Air, we look at how colonialism and the Cold War set the stage for many of the economic and political problems in Africa today. First, we'll hear from Martin Meredith, author of The Fate of Africa, From the Hopes of Freedom to the Heart of Despair. Then we'll hear from Michaela Wrong. Her new book is the story of how the world betrayed the small African nation of Eritrea. It was colonized by Italy, later became a pawn in the Cold War, and developed into a case study of what's gone wrong in Africa. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Historian, the debut novel by Elizabeth Kostova about the Dracula myth. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Live 8 concerts were conceived to raise awareness about Africa's economic and health problems. The G8 summit starts tomorrow. To understand Africa's problems, it's helpful to understand Africa's history. In a few minutes, we're going to look at one small country, Eritrea, and see how the impact of colonialism, the Cold War, and border wars make this country a case study in what's gone wrong in Africa. First, we're going to hear from journalist Martin Meredith, who has covered Africa and written several books about it. His new book, The Fate of Africa, is about post-colonial Africa, but the introduction explains how Europe staked claim to virtually the entire continent at the end of the 19th century. Your introduction starts in the 19th century when European powers divided the continent. Was there actually a process in which the European powers met and decided on how to divide the continent?
They met over many years at meetings in London and Paris and Berlin and other European capitals, and not knowing very much about what was going on the ground in Africa, knowing little about the geography, and many of the boundaries that they decided on were entirely arbitrary. The lines that they drew on maps were very often straight lines or lines of latitude, lines of longitude. And what that meant was that the colonies that they created were essentially artificial right from the start. There were in Africa at the time something like 10,000 African polities or African societies, and these were all amalgamated and carved up and reduced into essentially 40 European colonies.
And so that put that divided some African cultures, and then also put some African cultures who were in opposition to each other within the same state.
Yes, there were some peoples like the Bakongo of today's Congo, or indeed the Somali, who were divided up. Well, the Congo was divided up between the French, the Belgians, and the Portuguese, and the Somalis were divided up between Britain, Italy, and France. So that's an example, if you like, of the way in which some peoples were rent apart by the arbitrary divisions that Europe imposed. But in most other cases, because there were so many small African societies, they were all thrown together in a sort of jumble to create new states. And many of them had no common language or no common culture. Some of them, in some cases, were hostile to each other. They were hostile neighbors who fought wars occasionally. And many of these were actually thrown into an artificially created state and essentially kind of told to get on with it.
What did the colonial governments do to try to make countries out of these different cultures, who, some of whom were feuding with each other?
Well, they started to use, if you like, European languages, which is one of the unifying factors. So the French obviously used, France used the French, and Britain used English. And that's one reason why today the most common languages that are spoken, apart from Arabic, are English and French and Portuguese. And that's the reason. Another sort of unifying factor was the way that European powers began to create modern economies. So they built roads and railways and ports, which began to provide a basic infrastructure. But there wasn't actually very much development that went on of this kind, because European powers believed that they had hundreds of years in which to work to kind of establish these new states. And they weren't particularly interested in investing it, investing resources there, other than to kind of keep law and order and maintain kind of public expenditure at a minimum. So there was pretty little development that actually went on for the first 20 or 30 years.
Leaders from the G8, Britain, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Russia, and the U.S. are about to meet. Africa will be at the top of their agenda, and among the issues they're going to discuss are aid, debt cancellation, and trade. Let's just break this down a little bit and look at some of the issues they're going to be covering. What will they be considering regarding aid to African countries?
Well, there's a movement afoot to increase the level of aid to Africa by the West to overcome its huge difficulties. There is, however, a serious difference in policy. That is that the Bush administration is in favour of much more limited aid to Africa, arguing that a great deal of aid that's been given to Africa in the past has basically been a waste. The difference of opinion comes between Bush and Tony Blair's administration in particular, but other European governments too, which want a huge increase in aid, so that and applying it across the board, not to identify in the way that Bush wants particular countries which are willing to abide by good government. So that aid is one of the main issues in contention, and it's one of the ways in which, if you like, people are looking for progress, but I doubt that there will be very much.
And what about debt cancellation?
Debt cancellation is in some ways easier to agree on, and indeed a great deal has already been agreed. It has been provisionally agreed and will be confirmed by the G8 meeting on Wednesday to write off an amount of $40 billion of debt, which is owed to multilateral institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. But since this was long-term debt, which was never expected to be repaid in the first place, the actual impact of debt cancellation is not going to be very great. The main impact is really kind of the extent to which debt interest does not have to be paid, and that amount is an almost trivial amount of $1.5 billion. But debt is by far the, if you like, the easiest route by which the West can address some of the problems in Africa. And for that reason, there's relatively early agreement on that issue.
And what about trade?
Trade is much, much more complicated, and there's not really likely to be much progress on that. It's complicated because there are so many entrenched interests in the West protecting their own producers with huge subsidies. The West, in general, spends roughly $370 billion a year propping up its own producers, its own farmers, with subsidies to ensure that they kind of survive. The consequence of this is that both American and European producers are able to produce everything from cotton to sugar to rice and a whole range of other agricultural commodities at a fraction of the price that African producers can produce their own products. And this has a very adverse effect on the ability of African farmers to grow what crops they like, because they're facing competition from Italian tomato growers, for example, or Dutch onion growers, who are able to produce products at much reduced prices. But because there are so many entrenched interests in that, and you can take US cotton farmers as an example, or indeed European tobacco growers, it's very unlikely that there will be any real progress on the trade issue.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Martin Meredith is the author of The Fate of Africa. Coming up, how the world betrayed the small African nation of Eritrea and why that country is a case study of what's gone wrong in Africa. This is Fresh Air. It's hard to think of another African country that was interfered with by foreign powers quite so thoroughly and disastrously as Eritrea, writes my guest Mikella Wrong. She's written a history of Eritrea that she describes as a book about betrayal repeated across the generations, and how the expectation of betrayal can both create an extraordinary inner strength and distort a national psyche. Her book is called I Didn't Do It For You, How the World Betrayed a Small African Nation. Wrong has covered Africa for Reuters, the BBC, and the Financial Times. Her previous book was about Mobutu's Congo. Why is Eritrea such a good case study, and what has gone wrong in Africa?
I think it's a good case study because it's a perfect example of how the proxy wars that America and the USSR waged in Africa wrought such damage. There were many countries like that in Africa, and the devastation was so much more extreme in Eritrea. So it is a very good example of that. And I think it also is an example of how societies that have been devastated by war then have a real problem adjusting to the transfer to civilian life. And effectively, Eritrea has failed to do that and is now stuck in a kind of permanent military emergency where everybody, every young person is doing military service, everybody's in camouflage, everybody's waiting to be invaded. That's not all Eritrea's fault, obviously, but there's a psychology there, sort of a war psychology that that really very much was exacerbated by the Cold War and is still very strong.
Can we throw in history of colonialism in the mix of what makes Eritrea a good case study?
Obviously, the colonial story is also the other aspect of this question. You had a very racist regime that was set up in Eritrea by the Italians. Mussolini, the great Italian dictator, thought of Eritrea as being the start of a great second Roman Empire he was going to build in Africa, and introduced a lot of extremely racist legislation, very similar to apartheid in South Africa. And I think that was also very typical of what the colonial powers did in Africa, and the kind of anger that laid down, that sort of slowly bubbled and fermented and finally blew up. So again, that's very typical. Every colonial power left a huge residue of fury behind them.
Funny thing is, when you went to Eritrea for the first time in 1996, during what turned out to be its short-lived period of independence, you were really impressed with the society there, and you thought, this is the exception. This is the country that's the African good news story. What was so impressive about it in 1996?
I think if you talk to anybody who visited Eritrea shortly after independence, they had the same feeling. I mean, everyone who went there just fell in love with the place. Firstly, it's this sort of bleak, dramatic, extraordinary landscape of mountains, this very high plateau, this crisp blue skies, crisp air, bright sun. And then this extraordinary city, because you're walking through a city that could be an Italian Riviera resort or a Sicilian coastal resort. And there it is, plonked at the top of a mountain. And then these extraordinary people that you met, who, unlike in sharp contrast with so many of the African places I'd visited, they had such a sense of purpose. They just won independence. They were all coming home. They were building homes for themselves. They had a very clear idea of exactly where they wanted to go, how they were going to build a new democratic society. They weren't going to depend on foreign aid. They didn't feel they needed to ask anyone outside for help. They had fought for their liberation, won it on their own. It was an extraordinarily invigorating place. And of course, at the same time, you were surrounded by all these signs of extraordinary suffering. I mean, every family you visited, they had these martyr certificate on the walls where they had lost members of their family who had died fighting the liberation struggle against Ethiopia. So, you know, people you met in the street, they were either sort of missing an eye or they were amputees, or they had sort of a couple of fingers were missing. I mean, this was a place that had been through hell and come out of it with a really strong sense of purpose. So it was a tremendously invigorating place to visit.
Of course, it was back to hell 2 years later in 1998. What was the cost of that 2-year war that started in 1998 with Ethiopia?
The cost was between 80 and 100,000 young soldiers lost on both the Eritrean and the Ethiopian sides. But of course, the real cost was much, much more than that, because you had a whole society that had been getting ready to become a democratic, a civilian society at peace, building the future. And suddenly, because there was this unresolved issue over the border with Ethiopia, which was then followed by a sort of storm of controversy, lots of criticism of the president, and then the president cracks down on the opposition and on the press, you had a society that sort of suddenly all the things that people felt they had fought for during the liberation struggle were compromised. The ministers who dared to criticise the president were in jail. The journalists were also detained. Suddenly people were looking over their shoulders, not daring to speak out, and a multi-party constitution placed on hold. And there was a sort of terrible sense of loss and shock and trauma, because these were the things that people felt they had fought 30 years. You know, they had supported this liberation struggle for these things, and suddenly they, you know, they were all on hold.
So how did Eritrea become an Italian colony, and how did Italy define its boundaries?
The Italians never wanted Eritrea itself. They were looking to the south. They were looking towards Abyssinia, today's Ethiopia, where there were green, fertile lands. They wanted a place where they could settle their farmers, because Italy was extremely poor. It was short of land. It was seeing all its farmers going off to America and South America and Canada, and it wanted a colony to settle its poor in, and it thought that Africa was the right place. But it didn't want Eritrea. It wanted Ethiopia. And what happened was that basically the Ethiopian Empire, the Abyssinian Emperor, stopped the Italian advance, and they were left just holding Eritrea, which was not the bit they wanted.
You say that because Italy wanted to colonize Eritrea in part to get access to more farmland, that Italy ended up stripping Eritreans of their farmland, and a lot of young men had no option except to sign up to fight Italy's colonial wars. What are some of the ways that Italy's colonization of Eritrea changed life there?
Firstly, the young men lost their land and became these mercenary fighters for the Italians. But I think, you know, it was a mixed inheritance, because on the one hand, the Eritreans felt they had been reduced to second-class citizens. On the other hand, this exposure to the outside world, this exposure to European colonization, did change Eritrea forever, and meant that a lot of Eritreans felt that they were superior, they were more sophisticated, they had more savvy than the Ethiopians to the south. So it was a double-edged sword. In some ways, European colonization brought them benefits. It brought them education, skills, know-how. On the other hand, they were also being treated virtually like slaves by the Italian colonizers.
And how did things change when Mussolini came to power in Italy?
It got a lot worse for the Eritreans, because Mussolini adopted this racist legislation, and he made sure it was brought in Eritrea, where it became, there had been a lot of mixing between the Italian colonizing, the settlers, and the Eritreans. They had taken local Eritrean women as their wives, as their mistresses, and they had had mixed race children. They were basically turned into bastards overnight. Italians were told that they couldn't have sexual relations with Eritreans, they couldn't marry them, they couldn't recognize the children, they couldn't adopt the children, they were not to fraternize. You were supposed to get, if you're an Eritrean, you're supposed to get in at the back door in the bus, you were supposed to sit apart in the cinema. Entire areas of town were roped off. You weren't supposed to go there at all unless you had a reason, because you were working there. So it was very similar to apartheid under the South Africans, and you were supposed to sort of step off the pavement and walk in the road if you saw an Italian coming, because obviously you were inferior. And this created a huge, huge sense of anger that rankles to this day, because older Eritreans still remember that.
And then Italy invaded Ethiopia in 1935. In 1936, Italy drove out Ethiopia's empire, Haile Selassie. Why did Italy invade Ethiopia, and how does that invasion change the region and change Eritrea?
The Italians felt they were avenging the Battle of Adwa, where they had been totally humiliated by Emperor Menelik's troops. And they wanted their second you know, empire, their Roman Empire in Africa, and Mussolini, who, you know, had these grandiose ambitions and was sort of now, you know, heading towards his great alliance with Hitler. This was his him showing his own population what a great leader he was. And it changed the region because huge swathes of the Horn ended up being in Italian hands. And with the outbreak of the Second World War, basically became very important to the Allies to deal first with the Italians before they could turn their attention to fighting the Nazi troops up in the Western Sahara. So there was a lot of fighting that went on in the Horn as the British troops tried to expel and get rid of the Italians in Eritrea, in Ethiopia, in Somalia, because they knew that they had to new to that threat from Mussolini before they could deal with Hitler's troops in the Western Sahara.
And did Italy's defeat in World War II end Italy's colonies in Africa?
Yes, effectively, they were stripped of their colonies, and Britain ended up running Eritrea amongst other colonies. And there was a 10-year British administration of Eritrea, which was a very grudging administration. I mean, the Brits were very superior. They introduced secondary education for the Eritreans, and they introduced a free press and political parties. But they were very sort of contemptuous towards these Italian colonies that they felt had been a massive waste of time and a massive waste of investment. And the Brits sort of were also responsible for a rather discreditable episodes, because they essentially, before they left, as they pulled out of the Horn in both Eritrea and Ethiopia, they set about stripping all the Italian infrastructure that had been left behind, because the Italians had really poured money into these two places. And they just dismantled the factories and the railway equipment, and the cable car was eventually dismantled as well. And all this equipment was dispatched off to British colonies elsewhere in Africa or in India and Pakistan.
Michaela Wrong is the author of I Didn't Do It For You, How the World Betrayed One Small African Nation. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, which include Everything You've Been Taught Is Wrong by James Lowen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants both to promote international understanding and address the root causes of global poverty. Online at Hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Michaela Wrong about the country of Eritrea. We'll also talk about the G8 summit, and Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book that takes off on the Dracula myth, The Historian, by Elizabeth Kostova.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michaela Wrong. Her new book about the history of Eritrea tells a larger story of how Africa was betrayed by foreign powers. Wrong is a journalist who has covered Africa for Reuters, the BBC, and the Financial Times. Eritrea had been an Italian colony. British forces defeated the Italians there in 1941 and took over the administration of Eritrea. In 1949, the UN established a commission to decide Eritrea's fate. The deal was brokered in 1952.
The UN was given the task of deciding who should run Eritrea, and there were two conflicting views at the time in Eritrea, which was that the Muslims, because it's a country that's divided between Muslims and Christians, the Muslims very much wanted independence, and the Christians were saying that they wanted to unite with Ethiopia, formerly Abyssinia, to the south. And because the UN simply couldn't decide, you know, which movement and which group was more powerful and more should be listened to, they came up with a compromise solution. So it was federated with Ethiopia. So it was semi-autonomous, but not quite.
And what was life for Eritreans like after it was federated with Ethiopia?
Well, it should have been a good time, but essentially what was happening was that the Ethiopians, who didn't accept federation, they were Emperor Haile Selassie, who was back in control in Addis Ababa, had always been obsessed with the idea of having control of a coastline. He wanted a port. He couldn't stand the idea of having a landlocked country. And so he essentially set about whittling away at the freedoms of Eritrea, sabotaging Eritrea's assembly. It had its own assembly at that time. And basically sort of buying the members of that assembly, buying them off, making sure that eventually they all agreed to dissolve themselves, dissolve the assembly, and Eritrea in 1962 became part of Ethiopia, became just its northernmost province. And that was supposed to be the end of the story, effectively, the end of the story of Eritrean independence, but it really just marked the beginning of what was going to be a 30-year war of liberation, because Eritreans who weren't happy with being swallowed up by Ethiopia went into the bush and, you know, joined and set up the rebel movements that were effectively to make life very, very difficult for the Ethiopian army for the next three decades.
In 1953, the United States enters the picture and it sets up a base there. Why did the U.S. want a base in Eritrea?
Well, this is one of the peculiarities, and I think I doubt if many people in America know it, but it's very familiar if you're an Eritrean, because there's a very high plateau. I mean, Asmara is sort of at the top of an escarpment. And because of its geographical location and its location in Africa, Asmara was actually the perfect place to listen in on half of the globe, and most importantly, on the Soviet Union, in terms of monitoring and picking up electronic signals and radio communications and all the sort of things that are sent out by powers that are trying to keep secret what they're doing with their missile programs and with their space programs. And Eritrea, it turned out, was a brilliant place from which to pick the stuff up and listen in. And so it became a very important, this is why Eritrea was such an important pawn in the Cold War, because the Americans were determined to stay in the good books of Haile Selassie, because they wanted to make sure that they were going to be able to use Asmara, to use the base they set up there, which was called Kagnew Station. And they wanted to use that to listen in on the Soviet Union. And in return, Haile Selassie demanded weapons, military training, jets. He wanted his men to go and be sent to military colleges in America. And so this was the tool that Haile Selassie used to get what he wanted, building up his army.
And what was the Soviet influence like in that part of Africa?
Well, at the time that Haile Selassie was building up his army and trying to turn it into Africa's biggest and most impressive army, which he eventually succeeded in doing, Somalia was vying with Ethiopia. So the Soviets were pouring weapons into Somalia and the Americans were pouring weapons into Ethiopia. And a lot of that weaponry was ending up in Eritrea because Haile Selassie was busy trying to put down these rebel movements that were giving him a hard time.
So the Cold War ends eventually, but the weapons are still there, the leaders are still there, the rebels are still there. So how did the end of the Cold War affect the region, like Ethiopia and the Eritreans who are living under Ethiopian rule?
Well, the end of the Cold War spelt the end for Mengistu, because he kept going to Russia and saying, I need more weapons, I need more weapons. I can't get rid of the Eritrean. I can't deal with the Eritrean rebel movements unless you give me more weaponry. And at a certain point, things were changing in Moscow, and Gorbachev had come to the fore, and he was saying, we can't afford to keep supporting all these disastrous African dictatorships, which are, you know, brutal beyond belief. And, you know, this is discrediting the Soviet Union in the eyes of the international community. We need to sort of start toning the whole thing down. So he basically told Mengistu that there was no way that Mengistu could keep looking to Moscow for weaponry. And essentially this spelt the end of that regime, because the rebel movements in both Eritrea and in neighbouring Ethiopia were growing more and more powerful. They started coordinating their attacks. They started planning things together. And then in 1991, together, they ejected the Ethiopian army from Eritrea. They rolled all the way down to Addis Ababa, and Mengistu fled and, you know, escaped, got on a flight to Zimbabwe and never came back.
And this kind of brings us to where we were at the beginning of the interview. The Eritreans get independence from Ethiopia in 1991. Things were looking pretty good. You were there in 96. You were really impressed with this flourishing, new, more democratic culture, people who were really excited by their independence and proud of it. And then they go back to war with Ethiopia in 98. That war lasts 2 years. And a special commission is created to help figure out what the boundary was between Ethiopia and Eritrea, and the two countries were supposed to agree to that. But they're still not in agreement, in spite of that special commission, over what the border should be. So there's still tensions between the two countries.
Yes, there are. And I think this is a sort of situation that's widely ignored, because I write a lot about Africa, and I often say to people, if there's going to be another war in Africa, it's probably going to be between Eritrea and Ethiopia. And we spend a lot of time sort of saying, talking about conflict prevention and warning systems. And it doesn't take a genius to sort of say, this is a warning. You know, this is a conflict that has to be prevented. This is a very dangerous situation. And I think, you know, what's happening in Darfur has shown that you really shouldn't have a situation where a border is still disputed. You know, 3 years after a Boundary Commission meeting in The Hague delivered its ruling. Okay, Ethiopia didn't like that ruling, didn't feel it was fair, but that's what happens when there's arbitration. And effectively, Ethiopia hasn't observed it, hasn't demarcated the border. So everything remains in limbo. I think that's a very dangerous situation.
My guest is Michaela Wrong. Her new book about Eritrea is called I Didn't Do It For You. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michaela Wrong, author of the new book, I Didn't Do It For You. It's about how foreign powers betrayed the small African nation, Eritrea. Excuse me here for reducing Africa to two generalizations here, but there are a couple of different schools of thought in terms of thinking through why so many African countries have been ruled by dictators and have been at war for decades, either civil wars or wars with other countries. And, you know, again, I'm just reducing this to generalizations, but one school would say, this is a problem. This problem has been created by corrupt, power-mad individuals who have ruled African countries and the regimes that they created. And another school would say, this corruption, these dictatorships are the legacy of colonialism and the Cold War. From your point of view, having covered Africa for a long time, where within those two generalizations does the truth lie?
It's a very difficult one. I often think the war between Eritrea and Ethiopia is sui generis. Firstly, the accusation of corruption doesn't really apply to either. These are ideologically driven leaderships, ideologically driven administrations. I think what happened in Eritrea and Ethiopia, and it's really hard to define exactly how that new war broke out or why it has proved so intractable. I think there was an element of face saving, not being able to be seen to step down. There was an element of brothers falling out because both leaderships had been very, very close, and both leaders, the president and the prime minister in Eritrea and Ethiopia, had been very close. And I think brothers can have a huge amount of resentment towards each other. And there was also, there were economic reasons. So I think the Eritrea-Ethiopia war was actually very different from other wars in Africa. It was between two national armies. It was fought almost, it was in sort of trench warfare, which is not something you tend to see in Africa. It really broke all the patterns. So I sort of would say it's just sui generis.
But not thinking just of that war, but of the whole history of Eritrea.
I think Eritrea's history is a perfect example of, if you take a small country and you flood it with weaponry, and then, you sort of abandon it or are thrown out, and then you go to the country next door and you flood that one with weaponry, you're going to have a pretty combustible effect. And the death toll and the losses and the destruction that you leave behind are going to be absolutely enormous. I mean, I think looking back, you have to wonder why either the Soviet Union or America thought that it was worth investing so much time, energy, money and weaponry in the Horn of Africa. You know, was it worth it? Did they get anything out of it? Kagnew Station was an issue, but that soon became overtaken by satellite technology, made Kagnew Station irrelevant. These were countries without obvious assets. There wasn't oil there. They were only vaguely in the vicinity of important allies like Israel. I mean, I think this was a sort of a perfect example of the Cold War thinking and how it made people go slightly crazy in those years. And it became important to support African countries because the other superpower was supporting their rival across the way. And the logic of, in exchange for this extraordinary suffering that you're imposing because you're funding armies and those armies are oppressing local populations in horrific ways, you know, what do you get in return? Is it worth it?
The G8 is about to meet, leaders from 8 industrialized nations, including the United States, England, Russia, France, Japan. Would you sum up for us what you think the importance of the G8 meetings will be?
I think the importance of the G8 meetings is probably emotional as much as anything. I mean, I've spoken to British officials here who, as you know, are very closely involved with it, and they're saying that a lot of the things they were hoping for have already been achieved. They're getting somewhere on debt relief. There's already been an announcement on that. Aid, there seems to be a general understanding, at least in Europe, although I think, in America, there's a feeling the Americans aren't really on board for this, that European countries at least are agreeing that they have to up their aid budgets to a higher level of GDP. But the really important thing, the thing that I believe would really make a big difference in Africa, isn't really the G8s to decide. It comes up before the World Trade Organization, and it's trade. It's things like European and American subsidies on our products. These are things that make it so hard for African countries to export, and it weights everything against African African recovery. So I think that in a way the G8 is emotionally important because it's making everybody in my country at least talk about these things. It's making people think about issues of debt, trade, subsidies. There's a lot more still to be done, and a lot of the stuff that needs to be done and is most important isn't actually going to be settled at the G8. It can't be.
Do you think mega concerts like Live 8 and its predecessor Live Aid are useful in calling attention to the issues in Africa? Do you think they're actually effective at doing that?
I think they're effective at mustering attention. and getting people thinking about things. What I find very frustrating as somebody who's written about Africa now for nearly 20 years is that the message becomes so simplified and it's distorted in the process. So there's a sort of horrible, I find the whole thing with this G8, the Africa Commission, the Live 8, there's a sort of patronizing sense that we can deliver recovery to Africa. It's in our hands, you know, it's in our control, and we, the generous, you know, well-meaning West are going to deliver a recovery to Africa. I mean, things are never that simple. You know, there's a whole issue of governance, there's a whole issue of leadership, there's corruption, there's a whole issue of countries that want to go to war. I mean, in Eritrea and Ethiopia, you have two countries, for example, that are still rearming in preparation for a future war. Now, where does what we decide in the G8 affect that? You know, this is not all in our remit. In my own guts, in my heart, I believe that Africa's recovery will come from Africa. And it's going to come from the young Africans I meet when I go there, who are educated, who are motivated, who know exactly what they want to do. They want to run their small businesses. They've all got sort of 3 mobile phones each, and they're extremely clear in their thinking. They don't want charity. They don't want help. They just want to be allowed to do business. I think those people are going to build the future. I don't think it's going to come from the West. I think there are things we have to do out of sheer human decency, and the trade issues come in there. But I don't think we can deliver, you know, salvation. You know, we are not the cavalry.
What are the other things that you think we can do under the category of human decency?
I think human decency, well, debt relief comes into that, but I'm not one of those people who think that you just deliver unconditional debt relief. There are countries whose dictators, you know, the Mobutu, who I've written a lot about, they just racked up these unspeakable debts, and it was outrageous that the West ever lent money to people like Mobutu. I mean, what were we thinking of? You know, this man was so manifestly corrupt, and everybody knew what he was spending his money on. So there are the issue, you know, the issue of odious debts. But I think we should also, you know, we have to be a little realistic and a little bit critical. I mean, when people, I work for a magazine that was recently saying, you know, talking about Angola and talking about debt relief in Angola, and you kind of think, well, you know, if you have a manifestly corrupt government in place like Angola, which is sort of brimming with diamonds and with oil, you know, is it for us to write off their debt? Because this is a government that has repeatedly shown that it doesn't give a damn about its own population and is quite happy to let sort of poverty levels, AIDS levels, you know, education, health go through the floor. Is it really for us to save Angola? I mean, I think it's time to get to be a little more realistic and a bit more tough talking with some of these horrible regimes that still exist in Africa. One of my main criticisms of the Africa Commission is that it keeps talking about this new leadership that's emerging in Africa. And I would like to know, you know, which leaders they're talking about, you know, which ones in particular, because I don't see those leaders.
You know, I'll be honest with you, Eritrea is not a country whose history I have followed in the past. I don't always read the articles about Eritrea in the newspaper. It seems very far away to me. I usually don't understand what's happening there. One of the things I really like about your book about Eritrea is that you point out, well, America, you were part of Eritrea's history. You know, during the Cold War,
yes.
You had a base there. You had a big spy
Absolutely.
Station
yes.
there. And you're part of the reason why there were all these arms. You're part of the reason why the Ethiopian government was supported when it was. I mean, so like all of us Americans have affected the history of Eritrea.
Yes, and I think, you know, that was a message I was trying to send out to readers, which is that we forget these places, but we sort of forget them at our peril. You know, just as we all forgot about what America was up to in Afghanistan, and that, you know, you could say that eventually that support ended up with the Taliban and then September the 11th. We all have a great tendency to forget our own country's histories, especially when they're a bit discreditable, like what my country got up to, Britain got up to in Eritrea was, didn't emerge from that experience looking very good. And I think the aim of the book was to point this out and say it's not to lacerate ourselves and flagellate ourselves and say, oh, weren't we wicked? It's more to say, you know, when you then meet countries and you sort of see them behaving in certain ways, it's really not good enough to sort of shake your heads and sort of think, gosh, these people are so extreme. Why do they behave like that? Because if you scratch a little under the surface and just do a basic amount of research and homework, you'll discover that there tend to be very good reasons why they behave they do. And that, you know, it's because often because of things we as Western, as sort of arrogant, clumsy Western governments did. And we've so conveniently forgotten this stuff. Sort of amnesia has set in. But the countries that were damaged and scarred by our own interventions do not forget.
Michaela Wrong, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Michaela Wrong is the author of I Didn't Do It For You, How the World Betrayed a Small African Nation. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new vampire novel, The Historian. This is Fresh Air. A novel about vampires prowling around dark forests and damp crypts in Central Europe may not seem like ideal summer reading fare, but The Historian, a debut novel about Dracula by Elizabeth Kostova, is shaping up to be one of this season's big beach books. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
No copying. It's the rule of law in grade school and the rule to ignore in the book business. By now, knockoffs of the Da Vinci Code surely outnumber all known scholarly interpretations of the Mona Lisa's smile. Seabiscuit sparked a galloping publishing interest in The Sport of Kings. Into Thin Air begot a veritable perfect storm of extreme adventure tales on sea and shore. Literary lookalikes can be the sincerest form of flattery or a cold-blooded marketing calculation, or maybe something else, like, say, an expression of the zeitgeist. Which brings us to The Historian, a suitcase-sized debut novel by Elizabeth Kostova that's shaping up to be this summer's Da Vinci Code. The Historian begins in the library of a narrow house in Amsterdam in 1972. Our unnamed narrator, a motherless 16-year-old American girl, ventures into her father's library late one night when he's away on a diplomatic mission. Out of idle curiosity, she reaches up to the top shelf of one of the bookcases and pulls down an ancient book, blank except for a central woodcut of a dragon. She also finds a cache of letters. The topmost one is dated from Oxford in 1930 and opens with these fateful words: "My dear and unfortunate successor, it is with regret that I imagine you, whoever you are, reading the account I must put down here. The regret is partly for myself, because I will surely be at least in trouble, maybe dead, or perhaps worse, if this is in your hands. But my regret is also for you, my yet unknown friend, because only by someone who needs such vile information will this letter someday be read." As you can doubtless tell already, subtlety is not the effect The Historian is aiming for. What follows for the next 600-plus pages is a series of deliciously maze-like quest adventures. Confronting her father, our narrator learns that the letters were written by his mentor at Oxford, a professor named Bartholomew Rossi, who vanished while pursuing research into the life and afterlife of Vlad the Impaler. He's the 15th-century Central European ruler who had a grisly predilection for skewering his enemies' heads on stakes and who was the real-life inspiration for Bram Stoker's Count Dracula. The main tale in The Historian splits into about 20 sub-narratives, roaming from medieval times to the present, in which scholarly vampire hunters, who are bitten by books rather than fangs, thirst after forbidden knowledge and thus wander into secret passages, monasteries, and most crucially, libraries scattered throughout the Carpathians, Turkey, Italy, Bulgaria, Hungary, and of course, Transylvania. Anyone who's read Stoker's Dracula will appreciate The Historian's garlicky riffs on that granddaddy original of 1897, which also was a book constructed out of quotes from other books, as well as letters, diary entries, and even bizarre contemporary inventions like dictaphone wax cylinder recordings. Only at the very end does The Historian run dry, but then the Gothic has always been a literary form that elevates the quest above the solution. Until those last 60 pages or so, I relished every blood-curdling moment of The Historian, but I do wonder what's up with our current predilection for paranoid tales that simultaneously assure us that there's an order beneath the chaos of everyday existence, but also warn us that that underlying meaning is ominous. Better not to read or to see too deeply into the surface of things is the perverse anti-intellectual message of erudite light novels like The Da Vinci Code and The Historian, where a little learning always turns out to be a dangerous thing, and a lot of learning or reading is tantamount to a death sentence. Indeed, the worst punishment Kostova's Dracula metes out is to damn his most tenacious pursuer to eternity as a librarian. Despite the condiments of arcane knowledge tossed throughout these recently published big books, they serve as secular Bibles of know-nothingism. The encyclopedic touchstones of the 19th century novel, like Moby Dick, Middlemarch, and Anna Karenina, are big books that challenge and disturb their readers and implicitly push them to seek out other destabilizing texts. These days, we seem to be reading big books that warn us to stay happy and dumb, or else, which for me makes The Historian a very guilty pleasure indeed.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of the forthcoming memoir, Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. She reviewed The Historian by Elizabeth Kostova. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And from the Skoll Foundation, celebrating social entrepreneurs and proud to sponsor The New Heroes, tonight on PBS, skollfoundation.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Michael Smith, the British journalist to whom the Downing Street memo was leaked, as well as several other secret Blair administration memos about planning for the war in Iraq. Also, we talk with Lauren Ambrose, one of the stars of HBO's 6 Feet Under. She plays Claire. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.